Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome to You're Making It Worse. We're here, we're queer, who cares? I'm Elliot Glazer.
And I'm Brent Sullivan.
And I'm H. Allen Scott.
Textual healing.
So this was an interesting article in the New York Times recently.
I frequently read
the Times.
But you read it for free because of having an LA library card, whereas I pay $17.99 a month.
Well, to clarify, I actually don't read it. I read the headlines, and then I presume what is in the article. But there were three reports that came out recently about closeted Catholic officials that have sort of rocked the Catholic Church. So according to the Times, analyses of cell phone data obtained by a conservative Catholic blog seem to show priests at multiple levels of the Catholic hierarchy in both the United States and the Vatican using the gay hookup app Grindr. Some of the reports by the conservative blog The Pillar allege just Grindr use and have led to resignations of high-ranking Catholic officials. Another report claimed that in 2018, at least 32 mobile devices emitted dating app data signals from within areas of Vatican City that are off limits to tourists. So there's a lot to unpack here. So we'll just kind of jump to it. The most obvious is that, obviously priests are supposed to live, celibate lives. And it is a surprise that they aren't.
I actually have a question about that because and I'm not Catholic, but I mean, from that one, there's some Catholic case or something where it's against Catholic doctrine to act on homosexuality, but it is not against Catholic doctrine to be homosexual communicate homosexually.
A very good friend of mine growing up was a member of a fairly progressive Catholic church in Ann Arbor. And she would always say that the priest of that church would say, it's not, we're mincing words here, but it's not about being gay. It's about acting out on being gay.
The Grindr app would
condemn you to hell for the rest of your days.
the Grindr app would be then, if that thinking is correct, because it's just communication if they don't act on it, which communication is not against doctrine.
Yeah. Yeah. So we have, that's sort of the first layer of this. The second layer is, of course, there's an equally worrisome correlation that the conservative blog, The Pillar, is trying to conflate homosexuality and pedophilia as part of a longstanding effort by Catholic conservatives to blame church sex abuse on the presence of gay men in priesthood.
I could see that.
Wait, still? I mean, how does that relate to Grindr, though?
Because they're pinning it on them because they're using gay or queer priests in general who are communicating on Grindr as sort of a smoke screen for see, they even have, they're using Grindr. So they're pedophiles and
they exist.
It's just conflating two things that aren't necessarily the same.
Right. When I saw it was a really conservative blog, you're like, well, I don't like where this is going.
Yeah, right.
This isn't about some sort of
The Pillar does sound like a gay newsletter though, doesn't it?
It does.
It does.
Read The Pillar.
The Pillar. And the final concern, which is I think relevant to probably everyone listening to this, is how did they use cell phone data to track users to Catholic-owned properties, data which many users, myself included, assume is unavailable to the general public? And that was not detailed in the article as to how. I mean, obviously, there's triangulation. You can get a general vicinity.
Is that the case in Italy, though? I don't know. Isn't this Vatican City that the data was tracked?
Vatican City, but also in the United States.
Oh, well, the United States is different. But I think in Vatican City, I mean, they're not under Italian law. So the data could easily be tracked by the Vatican. easily.
So you think the Vatican leaked this data to the
pillar? Well, I'm just saying that like it's not under like U.S. protection laws of data or whatever. So like the Vatican can do whatever the fuck the Vatican wants to do because it's in its own country.
Right. I see what you're saying. I don't know. I guess I found that very surprising, which is like, you know, like I was saying, like you can get a general hunch of where someone lives in the city by like seeing how far they are from you or something. But like... Mm-hmm. I wouldn't have expected that people could basically pinpoint you to a certain location to ultimately determine that you are in a Catholic area of the city or something. That's pretty jarring to me.
Yeah.
All of it is, it's very creepy that like the data is being, I guess, breached or technically not breached or the idea that like you can be found that way, but also the idea that it's like, permeating in church is just it's just so like it's too predictable at this point. Mm-hmm. And when you sent me the article, I was like, oh my god, like this just feels like a remnant of the past that it just feels like the Catholic Church bangs its head against the wall trying to get away with rules that go against like not human behavior.
Yeah.
And then to continue to try to conflate it with pedophilia is I don't know. It just
Catholics
feels like
it's got no chill. 2000s. Like, I mean, it's just like, all organized religion can have issues, but like, I do feel like Catholics just have no chill, or even evangelicals too. It's like, just chill the fuck out, do your Jesus thing, do your God thing. And like, just be chill about it. You know what I mean? Like Jews are not chill, but at least they're not like, going around talking about Grindr data, like they're
getting in your other people's business as much.
Just chill out and do your thing.
Do we think that the priests, when they're on Grindr, they're like completely catfishing, or it's more of a? Do you think they're leading with catfishing or leading with anonymity?
Anonymity.
Oh, catfishing. You mean not like catfishing to get like nudes or something?
I don't know. Yeah, I guess like.
I mean, I would imagine that if you're not allowed to act on your sexual sort of like interests, then it probably manifests itself in ways in which they just want to be able to communicate and maybe share nudes or like talk sexually about stuff or whatever. I don't know. Like it's just sort of like release in a way.
Yeah. I was gonna say something. I forgot. Damn it. I like had something like
I left ready to Brent go. Speechless.
May Jesus strike you with the memory of
of unhinged behavior.
Not even joking.
Today's guest, the first time I came in like aware of our guest's work today, I was in St. Louis, Missouri at the Tivoli Theater seeing Psycho Beach Party.
Stealing money. Okay. Yeah.
And it was a life-changing experience. So I'm so excited to have today Charles Bush on the podcast. Hi, Charles.
Hey.
Hello, darling.
How are you?
I'm doing very well. So I'm curious, were you just a child or a
I was a child, a yes. I was working at the movie theaters. I probably should have been working. I think I was probably working at the theater at that time. And I saw the film and I was just like, this is everything. This is drag. And the person who's in drag wrote and directed and stars in this thing and like created it for themselves. And like, you really are kind of a legend of drag, but also of theater because you sort of created this character and then did your own goddamn thing, which is kind of incredible and unheard of in a lot of ways. Like, I mean, what is it like to be a legend?
It's peculiar, really. highly enjoyable. I'm so glad to hear you say that because a friend of mine today on Facebook, I just don't understand people, shared a review of the from some TV, you know, website or something of the movie Psycho Beach Party, which, you know, it's many years old, and tagged me and so, you know, this wonderful review. And the review said, the critic said, I love this movie. The only thing rotten in it was Charles Bush.
Oh, my God.
No.
Why would my friend post and think that, you know, I would think, oh, what a great review.
How funny.
Well, your friend is like our friends here, because some of our friends on this podcast, in fact, will go onto our own podcast and leave reviews about the other hosts on this podcast. Mm. Brent Sullivan.
Mm. Once or twice.
I do think that people who aren't in the showbiz, you know, the idea just that your name is in print, mm-hmm. is so exciting. Yeah. They're not aware that it may just be hideous and
very hurtful.
Yeah.
Well, you have a new film out called The Sixth Reel, which it opened at Outfest here in Los Angeles, and it's really exciting. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, it's we're just beginning to give it out to the world. You know, we had our first public screening at Outfest, and we got an award for nice. Best ensemble, acting ensemble, which really is much better than getting an award for yourself.
Right.
That's
right.
Performance. It's better to get one for the whole company, really. So then we're going to be showing it at different festivals, and we're in the middle of figuring out exactly how to get it released to the general public. Mm. So
what is it about?
Well, the movie is a madcap contemporary comedy caper movie, mm. and it's set in the world of obsessive classic film collectors and dealers. And I play a male character in this one. Actually, I play a disreputable. It's a big stretch. Disreputable movie memorabilia collector, and I stumble across this rare, legendary silent film that was thought to be lost forever, and I get it, and I have to decide whether or not to do the right thing and, you know, give it to a museum or TCM or something, or do I sell it to a private collector and it'll never be seen again for a lot of money. All sorts of madcap hijinks ensue as the film is stolen from me and I have to get it back, and there's sex and romance and hilarity.
That's great.
My great cast. We got Margaret Cho and and handsome Tim Daly, and just about the rest of the cast, really, almost every one of them has either won or been nominated for a Tony Award. It's a very theater heavy cast. So, I mean, it's very exciting. Yeah, I can't wait for everybody to get to see it.
That reminds me, there was always an urban, I don't even think it's an urban legend, I think it's been verified, that Jerry Lewis created a movie about being a clown. In the Holocaust, and it came out so poorly that he made the studio give him every copy, and he said it will never be released. And apparently, it's like no one has ever seen it. Have you heard that myth?
Yes, it's called The Day the Clown Cried. I think
that's right.
I thought I may be wrong. I feel like I read that it was found. You know, everything is found. You know, we know where the Titanic is. We know where what happened to Amelia Earhart. Anastasia, she's been, you know, we figured out that mystery. So I kind of think, you know, it's they found Jerry Lewis's movie.
Yeah. That's
wild.
Next up, YouTube. Go ahead, Alan.
Well, like, one of the things I think that when I first saw Psycho Beach Party, and when I first sort of came across your work, I was in Missouri, so I had no access to sort of like New York drag or like the history of drag. It was very sort of like foreign to me. And when I researched a little bit of your work, it kind of blew me away how like you created, I mean, you are Charles Bush, so you never really created like a fake drag name or anything like that. You kind of did drag in your own way in the 80s, where you sort of created this character for yourself, but it's still you.
Well, it's more that, you know, I never performed in a drag act in a club. You know, I never lip synced or just performed solo as a drag performer. Now, the whole thing with me was theater, mm-hmm. and I'm from New York originally. I was born here, and the dream was always to have a career in the theater, mm-hmm. being on stage. And I always was interested in writing. I was writing full length plays when I was 11, and so that was always the idea. But when I went to Northwestern in Evanston, Illinois, I was a theater major, and it became quite evident to me after a while that when I was never ever cast in a play, that I was just, you know, seemed too gay and too androgynous, and whatever I was, they didn't want. And I'm very, you know, pragmatic person. And I thought, well, if I'm not being cast in university theater, I may have a hard time of it in the professional world.
Right.
and then I started seeing, being from New York, particularly when I was come home for on vacations, I started seeing more experimental theater and downtown theater. Mm. And it was, saw that you could, that there was a whole nother kind of theater besides just the commercial Broadway plays that I grew up watching, mm-hmm. and that I could create my own theatrical world if I chose to. So I began writing roles for myself starting in college. And I just, you know, I thought whatever, I figured out just that, or, you know, that whatever it was that people thought was so strange about me or so commercial, maybe that's actually what was unique about me. Mm.
And how did the move go into, would you call it drag or would you call it female impersonation or is it a mix of both or?
I just wanted to play, write myself roles that I could be wonderful in. And I was always very, you know, very attuned to the feminine in my nature. Mm-hmm. No, I was always doing, I had a knack for female celebrity voices of actresses from the golden age of Hollywood,
right,
early mm-hmm. on. And it was just a question of how do I actually do that in the context of a play. So it was always being in a play. So I never, you know, back then things are very different. It's so hard to talk about this sometimes and not come off like I'm being patronizing to somebody else.
Patronizing. It's fine. We do that all the time.
I'm talking about 1972. Things are very, very different, you know? And so I just didn't think of myself as a drag queen. I thought it was just that I was an actor who created these female characters.
Mm, right.
Mm-hmm. And actually the first part of my career, after I graduated college, I wasn't in drag because I didn't know how to, you know, how do you really just start putting on a play when nobody knows you and there's no money and all that. So it was easier to start as a solo performer. Mm-hmm. And I wrote myself these solo plays where, you know, they were very elaborate narratives. They're almost like screenplays. And I played all the characters, male and female. Mm-hmm. And I didn't change costume. I just changed, you know, voices and told this story. And I did that for about 8 years and booked myself in small nonprofit theaters around the country and just learned and grew and got better. But I did sense that that the female characters really were the most vivid. They were ones I enjoyed the most. I played the male characters just because in the story I needed those characters. And I remember someone said to me one time, well, why don't you just play the female parts and write a piece where you're just the female characters? And I thought, I can't do that. And I thought, well, why can't I? You know, and then I finally got some friends together and we actually put on a play where I didn't have to play those male characters. I could just mm-hmm. play the one female character that I knew I could do really well.
What is it about, like, there is something, we've talked about this on the podcast before, there is something about sort of those female, the women in film and television and music who are kind of like the outcasts, you know, the Barbra Streisands, the Bette Midlers, the Liza Minnellis, the ones that like aren't the typical beauties or aren't the typical whatever, but yet queer, gay men specifically, but queer people sort of they gravitate towards them. And similar to, Whoopi Goldberg. Whoopi Goldberg also would be in that, I think, too.
Yeah.
Where we celebrate them in a way. And sort of a lot of what your drag is celebrating these women of sort of old Hollywood mm-hmm. as being powerful. I mean, in Psycho Beach Party, you're like the you're the person who's solving everything. And she's this glamorous sort of woman solving all of the problems and figuring out what's going on. And It's a real power statement. Like, what is it about those characters that sort of queer people respond to, do you think?
I wonder, really. I think it is, so you kind of nailed it in a way that they're often women who who could be marginalized, but somehow find this power within them that and I mean, somebody like Judy Garland, I guess, would mm-hmm. definitely be in that group. And you know, and I think so much is made about her being kind of this sort of victim, when I think her appeal to so many gay men, particularly when she was alive, was that all these terrible things might happen to her, but she's going to get up there and keep singing. And for every, you know, I don't think you really listen to Judy Garland records when you're depressed, like Billie Holiday, you would.
Mm, yeah.
Because Judy Garland, for every Man That Got Away chart song, the next one is she's singing, you know, It's a Great Day for the Irish. And, you know, she's singing a big march up tune, Get Happy.
Yeah.
Right after she's singing some very sad song. So it's all up with her. And I think, you know, the other ladies too, it's about the comeback. It's about the, you know, I may be down, but I'm coming right back up again, and I can't be defeated. That's inspiring. And I don't, it's hard for me to speak for gay men today, because you know, I'm you know, quite elderly, even though I know I don't look it, but I am. And so I you know, I can really only speak for my own generation, mm-hmm. and, who responded to these women, but I would imagine, so I don't know. I mean, do people, I mean, did Lady Gaga and Beyonce, do they fit that pattern a little bit?
I think so. What do you think, guys?
Hey, I think Gaga does. Beyonce's, I think it's sort of moved to this like place across the board, not just with like gay people, but like it's moved from like quirky outcast to like worshiping fierceness. And not just like with people like Beyonce, but just like, you know, Jonathan Van Ness or whatever, anybody who's like unapologetically, you know, truly like unapologetically, like fierce and unrelenting in a way, is just, I think that's sort of taken over the old character who's like more quirky and you know, not traditionally attractive or whatever the unkind words were for unattractive.
Right. Because like Beyonce is just spectacularly beautiful. But then, you know, there's also, you know, gay men of, they also, as far as black divas, you know, Diana Ross was beautiful and powerful.
Whitney
and
Houston.
We all loved her. And then later Whitney Houston.
So
I guess there are different kind. I guess really it's hard to generalize. I guess there are certain female icons who have this kind of vulnerability that mm-hmm. and have, despite everything, they're going to sing. And then I guess there's the other kind of fierce, tough person who, just, it's somewhat different. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. The other thing that sort of blows me away about your career specifically is, you know, Psycho Beach Party came out, was 2000? I forget what year.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah. Somehow.
And then Die Mommy Die was shortly after that. And then you had an amazing Broadway play called The Alger's Wife.
The Alger's Wife.
Yeah, Taylor the Alger's Wife, which was nominated for the Tony Award for Best Play. So you had, you know, some great success in sort of 2000 and on with this sort of, and even though you weren't in the play, it was by you, and it sort of had that Charles Bush sort of element of fierceness to it in sort of the characters. And like, one of the things that sort of blows me away about your career is you were building up this character and doing these plays in New York and sort of building up this persona over the course of the modern gay rights movement, and how you single-handedly are able to write, direct, star in these movies, in like these big movies, and get sort of the pass to do it at a time when they weren't really giving a lot of queer people the ability to tell queer stories, let alone a drag queen be the star of a movie that, you know, a big studio produces.
Well, they were indie films. I can't try.
Yeah, they weren't. It wasn't big. But,
yeah, they were.
Yeah, but it got released. It got wide release, which is a thing. Yeah,
Yes, it did. I don't know. I don't want to be false modest or anything, but some of the big battles were fought before me, mm-hmm. you know, in the 60s. But I think of myself as first generation post Stonewall. And so I came along at a pretty good time, although it took me, you know, no, I didn't get my big break till I was 31. I mean, I guess at the time it seemed forever, and I felt so old, when actually I guess 31 is not bad to have your break.
yeah.
Yeah. So, but that, and that was, that was, it was, I got a lot, I think you have to, be in a position, you have to make yourself available for luck to find you. Mm. I really believe that. I really believe that. And sometimes it has to, you know, I was frustrated in my 20s. You know, I couldn't totally earn a living as a solo performer. And, you know, I draw very well. And so instead of being a waiter, I earned my living a lot of times as a quick sketch portrait artist on the sidewalk.
Oh, really?
Oh, wow. What was that? What was that like?
I didn't care for it too much because, you know, the unspoken contract is that if the person doesn't like the drawing, they don't have to pay for it.
Oh.
And out of like maybe the 10,000 portraits I did, I think only maybe twice did somebody not like what I did. I became quite a, you know, I didn't do caricatures. I did like get a portrait pastel, looks just just like you. And I learned pretty quickly though how to make a big nose diplomatically smaller and a weak chin diplomatically larger, and just, you know, make everybody look pretty. And so I used to I did that, and I worked on the boardwalk of Wildwood, New Jersey, and just all sorts of things to earn a living, just trying to, trying to do it. And meanwhile, doing my solo shows in different cities and getting a following, and in San Francisco and Washington, D.C., and Chicago. And
just you've taught as well, too. Oh, sorry. Go ahead. I need to interrupt.
Well, I was just going to say, though, that in a certain sense, as frustrating as it was, and I was always just, you know, I was such a bore to, particularly the men that I was dating, because it's just, you know, we went to see any kind of play. It was like, I should, why aren't I up there?
You know? Right. Really,
there was an older man I was dating for a while who was much older, who was, I guess, like a investment counselor or something. And he finally, he had enough of me. Before he dumped me, he said, oh man, because in any other profession, you'd be a, you know, a millionaire the way that, with your obsessive drive, you know, but just the theater is so hard.
Yeah.
But, yeah. But that paid, I mean, you had the one of the longest running shows of the longest running plays on Broadway.
Well, but then before that, it was my big break was, and it was probably a good thing that it didn't happen 5 years before when I wasn't ready, when I had, because I'd had, my big break was just, I don't want to, I talk about it so much, I don't want to waste time on it. But anyway, I very quickly, just kind of for the fun of it, wrote this little play, you know, and I called it Vampire Lesbians of Sodom. It had a crazy title, and I got a group of friends of mine together, and we put it on in this bar art gallery on the Lower East Side. It was very kind of a strange neighborhood, and we were in the right place. It was called Vampire Lesbians of Sodom, and we were in the right place at the right time. Mm-hmm. And there was a lot of interest in that neighborhood of the East Village in the mid 80s. And Madonna had come out of that world, and Keith Haring, and we were just in the right place, and the play took off, and we produced it ourselves off Broadway for a regular commercial run. And it ran 5 years. It's one of the longest running plays in the history of off-Broadway. And that's what established me as a commercial writer, you know, and I played the female lead character in that. And from that moment, I could earn a living just in the theater. And that led to all these other wonderful opportunities. But I just kept doing it myself. I had to always do it myself. And that's not exactly right. I've been very fortunate throughout my whole life that I've connected, starting with my aunt who actually adopted me and raised me. There's been a series of people throughout my life, continuing to this day, who've somehow I've attached myself to, and they've attached themselves to me, who have a lot of focus and concentration and get things done. Mm-hmm. And they've kind of taken me and my eccentric talents and made it possible. You know, they've all been, several have been my directors and producers, you know? And so I've just been very lucky that way, because I'm not really a detail person. And on my own, I wouldn't have been able to do these things, but each of these friends of mine who I worked with for many years, they made things happen, and they made it possible for me to tell my stories and be and be this leading lady.
Yeah. Yeah. You also were on a, I mean, not only were you, was Psycho Beach Party sort of an awakening for me creatively as sort of a writer, comedian, drag person, like it sort of, it helped open my eyes to the possibility of queer sort of art mm-hmm. in a way, but you also were on a show that was my sexual awakening Oz on HBO. I can't tell you Oz was probably how I realized that there are a variety of male nudity that I could enjoy. What was it like working on Oz? Because I've never talked to anyone. No, I talked to Christopher Maloney about working on Oz, and I talked to him about his butt. But you're showing the second person.
Yeah.
I could talk to him about that. Yeah. Well, what did you think of Christopher Maloney's butt?
It was riveting. Well, funny thing with that, but see, everything, you know, you get one kind of success, and then that opens the doors for other things. And I never wanted to pursue an acting career beyond my own work. I just thought, I didn't think I was very good at it. My talents lie within a very specific thing of creating these mainly female characters, although I've now gone, actually have played some male roles occasionally. But anyway, I was a big fan of that show. And I mentioned it to my late manager, Jeff Melnick. I said, oh, don't you love that show? He goes, oh, it's too violent. And I wasn't really serious because I don't pursue that kind of career. But I just said, wouldn't it be kind of cool to be on a show like that? And he was always trying to get me to be in other people's work. And so he called the casting director and she said, oh, I think that's a great idea. And then I knew Tom Fontana, the creator of it, a little bit through a mutual friend. And they shot it just around the corner from where I live. And so he called me up and said, why don't you come over? And I went to his office and he said, love to have you on the show. Who would you like to play?
Wow.
And so I said, well, listen, I said, you know, I'm the least street person there is, darling. However, I said, I could play someone who seems rather fragile and delicate, but is just lethal. Yeah. And so let me think about it. I thought, oh, that's the end of that. And then later, I got a call from the company saying, what are your available dates? Are you available and start shooting? And
wow. Here's the
character. And it was exactly really what I described. And
that's really cool.
It was just fascinating. And, you know, they shot it all in this, at that time, those first seasons when I was on it's called the Chelsea Market Building.
Oh, yeah.
Not far from where I live. And, you know, so that whole set was just this permanent, huge Oz prison. And they shot all in every possible space. So like if I'd be in the dressing room, certain times I couldn't open the door because they were actually shooting in the hallway.
Oh my God. And wow.
They also never, if they had scenes that took place in other cities like Miami or Guatemala, it was always the same street, 16th Street. And they would just dress up 16th Street to look a little different. But I found it thrilling. I just got a little at the end. The first couple shows I did, you know, it was very exciting because I got into drag and I killed an old elderly mafia don.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
And because of that, they put me on death row. Yeah. And then they invited me back for a second season. Mm-hmm. And I thought, oh, well, you know, they're going to really give me lots of storylines. And Chris Maloney and I will have sex. And,
right.
And then once you're on death row, there's really not much they can do with you.
Yeah.
And my character had AIDS. So between the AIDS and death row, it did not bode well for too many episodes.
Yeah.
Each episode, I started getting sicker. And they started killing off people on death row. I said, oh, this is really bad. This does not bode well for me, you know? And so I thought I have to be proactive here.
Yeah.
So since I don't pursue that kind of acting career, I don't worry about burning any bridge. Mm-hmm. So I just, no other actor would have done this. I wrote a little note to Tom Fontana and I suggesting, I said, I'm sure you have it all worked out. I'm sure it's great. However, what do you think if when I go to the gas chamber, that if I get dressed up in drag, like Susan Hayward and I Want to Live,
yeah.
and Rita Moreno, who played the lay nun, Sister mm-hmm. Pete. I said, and if Rita could, then comes into my cell and sort of helps me do my nails. And then I go to my death with great defiance, you know, and fuck you to everybody. So he said, that's very interesting. Script arrives and I'm dressed up like Susan Hayward.
Oh.
Rita Moreno comes into the cell, helps me with my nails. Then it gets different. I start to faint. And she says, why don't you lie down? I'll see you in the morning. And when they come and get me, I've died in my
head. Oh, no.
And so she had a huge, it was a big scene for her.
Wow.
Well, she is Rita Moreno. I mean, let's like.
Rita Moreno, yeah. She got a real big dramatic scene out of it. So she kind of owes me on that one.
But well, then it was what a way to go.
When I died, but then when I died, you know, it was supposed to be a slow pan, mm-hmm. camera pan over my dead face. And then all the way to the warden and B.D. Wong, who was the priest, and Rita Moreno was a nun, and all of them watching.
Talk about a gay. But
it's very difficult. It's more difficult to play dead than you would think. Mm-hmm. And they do very few takes on Oz. It was fast, fast, fast. So the cameras panned, and then suddenly the I guess it was the AD said, we saw his eyelids twitched. His eyelids twitched. oh dear. So then Rita comes over to me and says, here's a big secret I learned when I was at 20th Century Fox. Keep your eyes closed for 5 seconds. Then before they say action, it's okay, I'll do it. I had my eyes closed and slow pan. So his eyes are twitching. His eyes are twitching. And B.D. Wong comes over to me and whispers, big secret is keep your eyes wide open before they.
Oh my God.
That's funny. I couldn't do
just
it.
Just tried them both. I just
finally
tried
it was just. Quick pan,
yeah.
Quick pan to the,
it was a quick death for Susan Hayworth. Well, yeah. Charles, I have to say, one of the things that I get really sort of angry about is when I'm talking about drag with people, and I do drag, and so like we talk about sort of the great admirers of people that I admire, we admire, and when someone doesn't know your work, I get violently angry, like your character Oz, and it makes me very very upset. So anyone listening, if you don't know Charles Bush, you're an idiot, but you should go and figure some stuff out, because you need to go watch these films and respect where it all started. Charles, thank you so much for doing this. We really appreciate you being
thanks,
here.
Charles.
I've had a lot of fun. Thank you, guys.
Of course. Thank you. And everyone, when the film comes out, you should go see The Sixth Reel. It's a lot of fun. And and go see it. Everyone, go watch all of other Charles Bush's films as well. They're really worth it. Thank you, Charles.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
And another thing.
So I wanted to play a clip for everyone. This is a video from NPR's Story Course, storytelling series. And let's take a listen to about a 2 minutes worth of this clip, and then we'll talk about it afterwards.
I'm riding to school with my oldest brother. And on the way to school, I'm putting glitter all over my face. And my brother said, what in the hell are you doing? I said, I'm putting on my costume. He said, well, I wouldn't be caught dead wearing that. So he dropped me off at the school and he called my dad up and he said, Dad, I think you better get up there. This is not going to look good. So my dad drove up to the high school and he had his farmer jeans on and they had cow crap on him and he had his clodhopper boots on. And when I saw him coming, I ducked around the hall and hid from him. And it wasn't because of what I was wearing. It was because of what he was wearing. So the assembly goes well, and I climb in the car, and I'm riding home with my father. And my father says to me, I was walking down the hall this morning, and I saw a kid that looked a lot like you ducking around the hall to avoid his dad, but I know it wasn't you because you would never do that to your dad. And I squirmed in my seat, and I finally busted out, and I said, well, Dad, did you have to wear your cow crap jeans to my assembly? And he said, look, everybody knows I'm a dairy farmer. This is who I am. And he looked me square in the eye. And then he said, now, how about you? When you're a full-grown man, who are you going to go out with at night? And I said, I don't know. And he said, I think you do know. And it's not going to be that McLaughlin girl that's been making goo-goo eyes at you, but you won't even pick up the damn telephone. And I'm going to tell you something today, and you might not know what to think of it now, but you're going to remember when you're an adult. Don't sneak, because if you sneak like you did today, it means you think you're doing the wrong thing. And if you run around and spending your whole life thinking that you're doing the wrong thing, then you'll ruin your immortal soul. And out of all the things a father in 1959 could have told his gay son, my father tells me to be proud of myself and not sneak.
So I've always loved this video because it's such appropriate modern advice packaged in the 50s and delivered by a gruff dairy farmer. And I just think it's so like novel. What did you guys think of this when you first heard it?
I thought it was super sweet. And I just thought it did feel novel. It did feel like different, you know? Mm-hmm. It felt like a nice sort of unusual way to, it felt unusually novel and full, wholehearted and earnest without mm-hmm. being like too, you know, I'm always afraid of storytelling because even I you've heard me talk many times about how I don't like the way that storytelling is all based on sounding like improvised,
yeah,
but also like very like, you know, affected and quiet, and then
so
at the end
affected.
It's like, and then the last line is always like, and that's when I decided, you
but
know,
but that's the opposite of StoryCorps.
Right, but that's what I'm saying. I'm usually afraid of storytelling, yeah. But yeah. Then this is clearly an exception to the rule.
Wait, Elliot, give us your best end of a story storytelling story.
Yeah, this is like at the Moth or like on like This American Life or something where the person ends and then says, and that was the last day I walked my bike up the hill.
Yeah, right. Oh, mine is always, and then I look outside and it was snowing. You're like, all right.
My old roommate had a storytelling show once where it basically was about her having migraines and it culminated in, and that is how I had a pain in the brain.
My friend dragged me to the Moth and I was like, you know, I'm not against storytelling, but I'm not. And I don't think storytelling is bad. It's just, this was like 10 people and they're all doing the same thing where they're mm-hmm. trying to make something. I mean, most of them, honestly, they're like white and their yeah. stories are not very mm-hmm. interesting. They're sort of like boring nostalgia. No, and it's like every story is about something of a bike or pudding or whatever.
we should clarify for people who, you know, aren't going to a lot of storytelling shows or improv shows or any of those shows like in yeah. LA or New York, in that there's a difference between the Moth and a yes. lot of these storytelling shows that we're talking about and StoryCorps. NPR StoryCorps
yes. right,
is
right.
fundamentally, it harks back to sort of what they used to do. They did it a lot during the Civil Rights Movement, during the Reconstruction, that where they would get slave narratives and they would just record people just sharing their stories, sharing a particular story that is highlighted so that it's archived in a way.
Mm,
and
yeah.
It's forever. And it's not performers, it's not people who are on stage telling a story, it's literally just someone sitting in their kitchen
yeah.
telling this one story,
and yeah. it's the way you kind of want to hear a story,
exactly right, that's what makes right. StoryCorps so unique. And I my reaction to this,
yeah,
I am a huge sucker obviously for any sort of like distant daddy stories because I have a distant daddy and
misty-eyed here
anytime
yeah.
No, it does. I get really emotional whenever it's like a dad thing because I don't
yeah.
have a relationship with my dad. I never did. I have a great stepdad, but like there
right,
is that sort of disconnect. I remember when I was watching that Pixar movie Onward. Do you know that movie Onward?
That's a good one. Oh yeah. My God.
And it's about the dad who died, and my dad didn't die, but like I have no right. relationship with him. And so when he had to like give up his dad, spoiler alert, it's been a few years, deal with it. And when he had to give up his dad and the memory of his dad, I was ugly crying to the point of I physically could not stand up at the end of the movie. Like I had
yeah,
to sit there and just like process
watch.
It. And this
right
story,
from the beginning of that movie,
it's an emotional film, but the ending was
yeah.
that really got me. And that it's the brothers and I have my brothers and oh my God, here we go again.
Mm.
Anyway,
two out of three getting misty eyed here.
With this one, it was really sweet because it's this sort of that idea of like, and what I always find surprising is a lot of times the coming out stories, you know, that I'm always struck by the ones where the mom is the one who has a problem
mm-hmm.
with the kid being gay and the dad, particularly with boys, and mm-hmm. and the dad is the one that was just sort of okay with it and just sort of
yeah.
like understood
yeah.
that male sexuality is strange and has a variant and what all these things.
Mm-hmm.
And this story really kind of personifies that. And it's really beautiful in that way.
You know, I still, this advice will pop into my head from time to time because I just think it's a really, it's just fundamentally good advice.
Don't sneak.
You know, don't sneak because if you sneak, it means that you think that you're doing something wrong.
Yeah.
And it just, it's also, it strikes me that in our world and in, I think, social media in particular, it's, social media is just absolutely saturated with faux whimsical mm-hmm. self-empowerment advice that's just so completely contrived to me.
Yeah.
Like sometimes, you know, every once in a while you find some Instagram page that has like a million followers and it's just literally just the dumbest motivational quotes that are like
empty platitudes.
Be you today, no one else.
Like, which is like,
what?
It blows me away that like, I mean, I think back to my high school days and when like, I was the only one that was out. I was so flamboyantly gay. I was very visibly, sort of like what Charles Bush was talking about, how like he was so gay that he was never getting cast really in anything or getting sort of being a part of anything. And I really felt that too, where, so I had to like make up this funny character sort of person, persona to sort of survive. And in a weird way, it was like my parents allowed that because they knew that that was my way of figuring out who I was. Mm-hmm. And everyone else just sort of had to come along mm-hmm. for the ride. And if I had like Instagram with those fake sort of like inspirational shit telling me shit every single day, I think I would have been a fucking mess.
I think I would be more depressed if I followed.
Oh yeah.
Because then I would be like, well, I can't, this person's telling me to be myself and I don't even feel like myself. Like I would literally have meltdowns every day about not being able to live up to this fucking Instagram inspirational shit.
Right. So that's why I feel like a video like this and the advice from it is sort of infinitely more meaningful than some diatribe on Twitter about being born this way or whatever.
Also in the video, there's the woman that keeps calling him, the girl that keeps calling him on the phone that his dad says, that's why you're ignoring. That's Sadie, actually.
All right.
That actually is Sadie. We'll post a picture of that.
What would your aunt say?
Brent, what would your aunt say about something she heard on today's show?
I also pronounce it Beyonce.
My aunt Joanne would say, you know, your aunt and I saw The Tale of the Allergist's Wife 10 times, 9 with Linda Lavin, 1 with Rhea Perlman. The show was around forever. It was unbelievable. How about Aunt Anne?
My Aunt Anne would say, wait, they can track the things we use on our cell phones?
Ray, delete the browser history.
I have a feeling she would sneak upon porn. Like, I feel like she would put in something and then all of a sudden it would just be like cum shots to the face.
Oh yeah. That definitely seems like it's up her alley.
Yeah.
Wait, was Rhea Perlman actually in that play, Elliot?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
It was Linda Lavin. It was Linda Lavin, wasn't it?
And Michelle Lee. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Sorry. Rhea replaced Linda Lavin.
Yeah, because Linda Lavin originated the role, I think.
Right.
Yeah.
And now, is Rhea Perlman in Come From Away? I can't remember.
Oh, my God. Before we go, the amount of messages that we have received from Apple putting Come From Away on their platform, people being like, are you going to cover this? Are you going to talk about this? Are you going to talk about this? We're going to do something.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. We will certainly figure something out. Right. Yeah. All right, everyone. That's Elliot Glazer. I'm Brent Sullivan, and he's H. Allen Scott.